I'm Jason Snell. Great twit for you this week. We've got Ben Brock Johnson, Andy Anatko, Brianna Wu. They're all from Massachusetts. I'm in California. We're talking about Apple. We're talking about Google. New phones, new rumors, and also who will speak for the bezels. Bezel-less displays are everywhere. We are going to have a really surprising debate about that. It's all next right here on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, episode 682, recorded September 2nd, 2018. I speak for the bezels.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by Betterment, the investing tool for those who refuse to settle for average investing. Sign up today at betterment.com/twit and get up to 1 year managed free. And by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. For a limited time, get 10% off any order with a mattress by visiting casper.com/savings. The special offer expires September 3rd, 2018, so go there right now. And by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by LegalZoom. Check out LegalZoom today to see how they can make life better for you and your business. For special savings, visit LegalZoom.com and enter Twit at the checkout.
Welcome back, one and all, to Twit This Week in Tech. I am not Leo Laporte. I am Jason Snell. It is Labor Day weekend. There are things going on. It's a little bit quiet. It's the end of summer, but there's stuff to talk about. And I'm here live in California. Unfortunately, no one else is. Fortunately, I have a wonderful collection of people in New England who are here via computer screen. Let me introduce our wonderful guests on today's episode of Twit. Andy Anatko is here, beloved technology industry pundit, regular appearances on MacBreak Weekly, and always when I think of Boston, I think Andy Anatko. Hi, pal.
Thank you very much. You caught me at a good time. We just got the lobster pots in. Putting in a good 2-day soak, and we got some blues. So we're real happy over here.
Didn't understand a word of that. Ben Brock Johnson is also here. He does a podcast with a different, I believe, Massachusetts PBS radio station from the one, or NP, what is it, public radio station, than the one that Andy does. We got lots of public radio here, too. Ben, yes. Brock Johnson, welcome.
Andy, Ed, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Andy and I are mortal enemies.
Mortal Massachusetts public radio enemies.
Only on the public radio inter softball league.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
I'm sorry.
I don't go to any of those games. But
there's a rule about how much pine tar you can have on the bat. If you read the rules, you wouldn't have used that bat. I'm very sorry, but that's
not mention the WBUR pine tar scandal of 2014. We don't want to talk about that. Also, I have to say, I'm very excited. This guest is running for Congress in, yes, Massachusetts. It's Brianna Wu. Hello.
That's right. You can vote for me on Tuesday. I'm really excited. I'm going to get to vote for myself for Congress. That is absolutely ridiculous. But before the show starts today, Jason, I do have a couple of requests.
Yes.
Since we're all Bostonians here, I have this written down. I wanted to ask you to please not insult our patron saint, Mark Wahlberg, today on the show. I would appreciate that. Or Tom Brady. It would just make us feel more comfortable. And, we'll try to rein in our Boston selves and not spit or kick or drink or do anything like that on the show today. We've got that on lock.
How do you feel about Ben Affleck? Can I say things about Ben Affleck?
I'm going to filibuster that.
All right. That's a good, I like the politic answer there. That's
my
good.
My third favorite Batman. Or live action Batman, I should say.
Live action. Thank you for the footnote in the middle of your weak praise for Ben Affleck. Let's talk about some technology topics. How about that? That is why the people tune in on Labor Day weekend, if they are out there, which I'm sure they are. I want to start with Apple because, first off, I have spent my career writing and talking about Apple, but also because we're in the silly season that is right before the big Apple event, which was announced it's going to be on September 12th, a Wednesday. They sent out an invitation to members of the media showing a golden ring that is basically the Apple Loop logo, although that didn't stop people from joking that they're going to release a circular laptop. That's probably not going to happen. They will almost certainly release new iPhones, maybe iPads, probably new Apple Watches as well. And one of the reasons we know about the phone and the watch is because 9 to 5 Mac discovered, basically, let's just say somebody put some graphics up on an Apple server somewhere using a guessable file name structure. And guess what? Somebody was guessing. And so 9 to 5 Mac has images of a new Apple Watch with edge to edge. It looks like basically the same shape of the Apple Watch, but the screen goes edge to edge. No bezels. If you are an investor in bezels, by the way, I'm sorry. It's a bad time for you. And the and new versions of the iPhone X, including a much larger version as well as a large non-OLED, an LCD version. There's an image of the two small and large iPhone X as well. So if you're at Apple and your job is keeping product security for just two more weeks and we'll get across the finish line, well, the sad trombone is playing for you. But we've got the information. We're on the outside. We don't care. We're not working at Apple. So what does everybody think? New Apple stuff is on the horizon. Andy, why don't we start with you? What do you? What's your read on what we know so far about what Apple's doing in a couple weeks?
I like the news about the new Apple line, the new iPhone line, especially the idea of having a humongously crazy, stupid, big iPhone X, because I really missed having the iPad mini to play with. And so now you can sort of, if it really is as big as they're saying, 6.5 inches diagonal, that will maybe give me some of that iPad mini love that I've been missing out on for the past couple of years. And I also like the idea of doing an iPhone XS, if that's really the name of it, basically finding a way to make something that is nearly as good as an iPhone X, but why don't we just take away the things that don't necessarily affect performance? Like, what if we switch to an aluminum frame instead of a steel one? What if we switch to LCD instead of OLED and be able to get the price way, 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 way down? Let everybody have Face ID, even the people who normally would buy like the people last year who would have bought the iPhone 7 or the iPhone 8. Isn't it great that they can have like the really cool notched screen? That is the other thing that if you've my great-grandfather, his first job as an Italian immigrant was on the factory floor taking notches out of screens, like the classical hand-tooled methods that he'd brought with him from Italy, and he would be out of a job now because if you don't have a notch screen, you earn nothing. So those are my two favorite things from the what we think we know right now.
Nice. Ben, what do you think about this?
Man, I just, Jason, I know you love Apple. I support you, but I'm so bored.
This is a safe
at
space.
This point.
Be bored. It's safe
this
to
is
be bored.
It's a place
okay.
Of safety and love.
I'm so bored. I'm glad this is a safe space to say this. Admittedly, I'm also an Android, so you know I have my Pixel first generation. I'm just holding on to that, waiting for that October 9th. The other event
we'll get there. Yes.
Yeah, we'll get there. But I think what is fascinating to watch as I guess kind of an Apple outsider is just how much like they just do one thing. They send out an invite with a circle on it, and that becomes a huge conversation on Twitter for like 5 days straight. Which I think is amazing. You have to give them that, right? You have to give them like what they do still matters, even tiny little design choices, which frankly, as near as we can tell, that's what we're going to see in this event, right? We're not going to see any huge leaps forward in small device computing technology here. We're talking again, as per usual, about changes in bezel, disappearing bezel, using a different metal that supposedly maybe will make the phone function better. Like, I guess I've just become that, you know, I don't know, old guy yelling in a room by himself, saying like, show me something amazing. And this is all incremental stuff, and that's fine. But I guess, yeah, I've become that guy who's like, make it and turn it into a convincing virtual reality, augmented reality device. Show me something amazing, and I'll be excited about Apple again. Until then, I'm going to yawn a little bit.
Must be nice to send out an invitation to an event that has nothing in it of interest at all. It's literally the logo for their new campus where they're holding the event, and have right. people spend several days talking about your invitation. If only, you know, a wedding save the date invitation got so much. But no, it's just Apple. Bree, what do you think? Are you more interested in this than Ben is?
So as you may know, over on Rocket, we're big believers in the rose gold lifestyle. Like we love rose gold. So that's, you know, I'm sorry, I'm that Apple fan. Like, they're releasing my favorite color iPhone.
The space is safe for you too. It's safe for you too.
Yeah, I'm just going to own that. Yes. I also want to say I love, like, the saddest thing about the server leak is, like, when I found out about it, I'm imagining, like, what goes on in Guangzhou with the people actually assembling Apple devices where, you know, they're patted down and x-rayed as they're going into the factory to build these things. And then, you know, back here in America, somebody just didn't think to, like, encrypt the server before everything is going live. And it all gets out. I find that deeply ironic. As far as this generation of iPhone, you know, we've had some real turkey S years, in my opinion. The 5S and moving to 32-bit and, you know, Touch ID at first, I don't think that was the best phone. But for this year, with the different sizes of phone, I'm really excited about this. I do think there's some room for a faster processor in the iPhone 10. I think it does stutter just a little bit. And for me, even though I know, like, the screen in it is bigger than the old 7 Plus, I just liked that bigger form factor. For me, on my campaign, I use my phone so much more than I use the Mac we have dedicated to it. So, you know, the idea of having more battery life and more screen, that's a product I'm very, very excited to buy, which is why I was sad that it looks like there's going to be no pencil support.
Yeah.
I'm sad about that too. That's a report. Who knows? It seemed to me like if they're going to do a giant iPhone 10, which is what we've seen, it seems like that's going to happen. That would be a great time to do a revision of the Apple Pencil and bring that support. Yeah. They've got all the software there from the iPad and bring that in, because you've literally got a phone the size of a notepad. Why not let people write on it?
They'd have to make a smaller pencil, which would also be a great
definitely.
Product.
Like a golf pencil, the Apple golf pencil. They could do it. I think in terms of the talk year versus, it's like a TikTok, it's the S year, as you said, Bree. The idea that at least doing this big phone is more interesting, a big iPhone 10, than if it was literally the same phones we saw last year. And then having this other large but cheaper phone is also something to give, even though Ben is bored, it's a little bit more interesting than if it was literally the same phones you saw last year, but slightly faster. Yeah. But I do want to ask about this, because I know a lot of people who really don't like large phones. And if you do like a large phone, bless you, it's great. But the rumors do not encompass an update to what we think of as the iPhone 8, which has been the shape and size of the iPhone for the last 5 years. And I wonder, you know, is that a problem? Is Apple's, I know there's a market for bigger phones, but is Apple basically saying if you don't like a huge phone, the iPhone 10 is your only option?
Oof, that's a good question. I'm a huge fan of big phones as well. Like, all of my phones have been huge since I had that option. and I really do think it has been interesting to see them sort of like take the place of tablets, as Andy was talking about. So like, I don't know. Again, it's like the question of, like, if Apple makes a move, does everyone just say, okay, I guess we're all getting big phones now if we want the new version? But yeah, I don't know. I think that's a good question, Jason. My guess is that, like, if Apple just makes a bigger version and is like, you have to get a bigger phone now, people will fall into line.
I feel like I have a really interesting perspective on this. They actually came out with guidelines for people running for high-level office, basically steering us away from certain brands of Android phones because of security leaks and hacking. So my campaign has literally every single size of iPhone that they make. I bought that for somebody on our campaign. For my call time phone, I don't use my personal phone. I have a different iPhone that I use for that. It's a little iPhone SE. I would love to see them update this phone as part of their line this year. I mean, mean, it's we've gotten so used to the bigger phones that when you hold the smaller one in your hand and you're just fitting in your purse, I think we've really forgotten just how awesome that is. I mean, like, it's a little small emergency phone that weighs nothing that you can use, you know, like as a backup phone. I would love to see them just update that, make it a little thinner and put it right back out. So I also want to say, like, I agree with you, Jason, that there are people that don't like big phones. There are people that don't want to spend $1,000 on a phone. Like we do, Simone DeRochefort, a friend of mine, she just absolutely thinks it's absurd to spend that much on a phone. And she's the person that goes out and buys that, you know, the model from last year at a lower price point. So I do worry that they're not going to, that they're going to be pushing us towards the higher end and are going to kind of ignore other kinds of consumers.
That's what's intriguing about the combination of having a phone that is the rumored cheaper phone, which is this 6.1 inch phone. Sort of like, well, wait a second. So it's cheaper, but it's also larger. And that's a little bit of a conundrum if you're somebody who doesn't want to spend a lot of money on a phone, but also doesn't want a large phone. But I guess it's also a great value if you do want a large phone that there will be one that's cheaper. Also, there's some rumors, I should just mention in passing, some rumors that maybe the iPhone X won't be $1,000 this year, that it might actually go down $100, which is still not a cheap phone, but it is cheaper than it was last year, and that might be good.
Andy? Yeah, that's one of my ongoing worries about Apple, that because they have the horrible responsibility of making literally every single phone that runs iOS and runs iOS apps, but they can't deliver the sort of broad accessibility that the Android platform can. And it's not just we have to remember that as convenient as the larger screens are for reading and for media and stuff like that, large phones are unavoidably sexist, because I'm a dude. I also am a dude with poor fashion sense, so I've got lots of pockets and they're all big. But if I were a woman, I would not have as many pockets and they would be not big enough for these kinds of phones. And if you're on the Android platform, you can actually seek out phones that are pretty much, if you just come up with a list of everything that you would like to have in a phone, chances are excellent that you can find it somewhere in Android. I've got in my library of phones, I bought last year a Kickstarter phone that it runs the second to latest version of Android, but it is literally about the size of like this battery charger pack. And it's a full touchscreen phone. It has dual SIMs. It has SIM expansion. It's unlocked, and I actually use it. I actually bought it because for $100, I wanted to have like a music player that would work with Google Music and all the other services, and also be able to contain like my entire music library. But I'm also using it occasionally when like I'm at the beach and I'm probably not going to be using my phone much, and it's okay for me to have lost or gotten wet a $100 phone. And I took it to a place where I needed to remind myself not to be on my phone, because that would have been incredibly rude. So I have this thing where I can just place text messages. So that's the problem, the lack of diversity, both economic diversity and size diversity. Right. So I think that Apple's missing a trick if they don't figure out a way to preserve at least the classic iPhone size and scale and keep that in the product line somewhere.
It's funny. I was actually just thinking that I see the signs that Apple's actually knows now that it has a problem with not, you know, for the longest time, the iPhone was literally an iPhone. Like, we can only make one kind, guys, so here it is. You've got the entire spectrum of Android phones and an iPhone. And if you look where they're going, if these rumors are true, we may see an Apple that is selling an iPhone SE, an iPhone essentially 8, this new large, lower-cost iPhone, plus the iPhone X size, plus this larger iPhone X size. At that point, it's like, okay, that, and with presumably a spread of prices in there, it's not going to ever match what Android can have. But I do wonder if Apple realized that what's holding the iPhone back at this point is a lack of diversity in the product line.
Yeah, they're running out of people to sell iPhones to, which means they're going to have to figure out why people aren't buying them, and price and size are probably two big reasons.
I'm also waiting for, like, this is the extreme trend, obviously, but I am also waiting for, I feel like more and more I run into people who are much younger than me who are basically like want a flip phone, basically want like the simplest, like are not like, do not make phone calls or pick up phone calls, are actually sort of suspicious of being always on their phone and using the internet on their phone, and are like, I'm sort of waiting for this, like, I feel like I'm seeing the edges of it just anecdotally of people, younger people who are like, you know what? A flip phone would be fun. Like if I can send text messages, which is basically all I do anyway on my phone, and maybe take good pictures, like that would be enough for me. So I feel like, I don't know, maybe that's too crazy, but I feel like there's a further extreme coming in the phone market. And obviously Android has some crazy options like this, or not crazy, but older options like this that run some of the more recent operating systems, but are much simpler phones. So I don't know. I'm curious to see in the coming 5 years if we see more of that.
One last Apple thing before we move on. I use the Apple Watch. I don't know if anybody else here. I know many of you have used it. Bree, do you use an Apple Watch?
Right there.
Yeah, there it is.
There,
okay. Well, so the rumor about the Apple Watch, where they, again, hey, there was a file on an open web server about an event that's happening in 2 weeks. What could go wrong? Showed the Apple Watch with this, edge to edge display. The idea is it's not necessarily going to be bigger, but there'll be more pixels on it, which I think is going to be a big win, especially for people who use the smaller of the models. I talked to a couple of designer friends I know who looked at this image we're putting up on the video version of this show anyway. That is this, it's got like 10 different complications on it. And basically what they all said is, oh, the horrors, that it's so junky. There's so much there. And as an Apple Watch user, I looked at this and I was like, finally, a watch face that I can put stuff on. Because for me, I was always frustrated that I couldn't get enough information on my watch face. I don't know if you feel that way, Bree, but that was definitely the first thing I thought of when I saw that image.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think it's worth saying, like, the Apple Watch has gotten so much better since that Series Zero. I mean, the first one I had it, and I remember getting it, and I work out every single day. I run, so I used it. But like when it finally died and the battery in it wasn't working anymore, I didn't replace it. Just like through a series of things, I ended up getting one with the cellular capabilities in it. And I really, really like the Series 3. So I almost feel like it's a shame that from the outside, it really looks like the same watch. And I think that's kind of unfortunate, because I think a lot of people that were kind of underwhelmed by this along the way, I don't know that they're going to be looking at a watch with a little bit of extra, you know, pixels around the edges and feeling like that's a product they should take a second look at. As far as the UI, I'm right there with you. I think it looks much better. But what I can't tell from that picture is if they've made it any thinner finally. And that's really my main complaint with it. You know, the battery life in the Series 3, it's okay. It's better than it was, but it's nothing to write home about. And, you know, it's a watch that, you know, like when I go on TV, I'm embarrassed to wear it generally. So I really would have thought they'd make more progress on it by now, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. Keep in mind, it was literally 4 years ago that product was announced. It's only been out for 3.5 years, and this will be the latest iteration of it. They've come a long way. I think you're right, though, that you can see that they've kind of emphasized features, and the software has really progressed in the last couple of years. It's way more capable as a device than it was, but it does feel like they prioritized all of that over making a big hardware, like a look change to it. And so it does look the same. It's this one will no doubt be better, but it does look the same. You got to wonder when they're going to finally just break compatibility. It feels like maybe now is maybe next year is the time where they say, I'm glad you bought all those watch bands. We're Apple. We're going to buy new watch bands now. That's just how it's going to have to be. Pay us more money.
No. They got your back. They'll give you like a watch band dongle, so you could just plug
adapter.
It into the dongle.
I need the new watch band C format and the adapter for it. Okay, we are going to talk about things other than Apple. There's a whole bunch on the agenda. But first, we're going to take our first break. Now, Leo, he's sending postcards from his trip, his beautiful trip. I only get to host the show when Leo is someplace beautiful. Seems unfair to me, but that's how it works. So we're going to go to Leo, who has a very special message for you.
Hi, Jason. Hi, gang. Let me interrupt just briefly because I want to tell you about a better way to invest. It's Betterment. And I just think this is awesome. Betterment outsmarts average, does better because it's the smart way to manage your money, designed to help customers build wealth, plan for retirement, and achieve their financial goals. Whether it's a down payment for a house, putting away money for the kids' college, or just a little nest egg, Betterment's technology is designed to help you make more from your investments. with tax-efficient investing strategies that will give you an edge. And Betterment provides unlimited expert advice designed to help you make smart financial decisions. Now, this is the key. The financial advisors at Betterment are fiduciaries. That means they recommend things in your interest, not theirs. They're not incentivized to recommend certain funds. They don't have their own investment products to sell. They work for you. Now, ask your current investment advisor if that's the case. It often is not. It is at Betterment. And the other thing I love about Betterment, because it's automated, it's doing things like tax loss harvesting, sometimes trading by the minute, by the hour, by the day. You know, it's not day trading, but they're constantly adjusting and rebalancing and making sure you're getting the most out of your investments. And none of that costs you extra. There are no hidden fees. No matter who you are, no matter how much money you invest, you get everything for one very low transparent management fee. No transaction fees, nothing else. No hidden end of the year. Oh, by the way, nope. You know ahead of time exactly what you're going to pay, and it is very, very affordable. Betterment gives you constant access to information and tools that allow you to track progress toward your goals, so you can always feel like a smart, savvy investor. You know, the kids today, they want everything. They want to see it online on the app, and that's awesome. You know, you complete control of it through the app. You're going to love Betterment. Do yourself a favor. Go to betterment.com/twit. Now, of course, investing involves risk, but you can get up to 1 year managed free right now if you go to betterment.com/twit. Betterment.com/twit. Young or old, new to investing, or an old hand, you just have to know Betterment outsmarts average. Betterment.com/twit. Back to you, Jason.
Listen to the man floating in the Mediterranean when it comes to making investments and living a good lifestyle. That's my rule. That's my rule. I'm gonna live by that. Okay, we're back here in the studio. I mean, by we, I mean me, and then everybody else is in Massachusetts. I want to talk about the Google Pixel 3. It sounds like it's going to be announced October 9th in New York City, so about a month after Apple's event. There are definitely things afoot. They are being approved by the FCC. A lot of stuff has leaked about them. And today I read that somebody left one in the back of a car. And and the Uber driver was very nice enough to take pictures and post them on the internet before giving it back to the person who came to claim it.
Apple's got to be feeling a lot better about that server photo leak. That was and that and plus Pixel 3 XL's boxed are being sold in the black market from someone in the Ukraine. So
great sign.
Yeah, that's okay.
There's no patch for human stupidity, as we like to say.
This is the world we live in. Try to keep things secret in this day and age, and it's not. Okay, Ben, you talked about how you were doing some eye-rolling at all the iPhone business. Here we are, Pixel 3. How do you feel? You excited?
I'm interested. I think the thing that annoyed me about the Pixel 2 was that you basically, and Apple fans will, of course, relate to this, is that you couldn't actually, you know, they got rid of the headphone jack, and the you had to get these new the wireless earbuds. And I think...
Or a dongle. A dongle. You could just attach a dongle if you could remember to bring it with you. Yeah, sure.
I'm not a dongle guy. I'm not interested in dongles. but I do think I'd like to see what they do with that, because I am still an old fashioned regular wired earbuds guy. I think the thing that most intrigued me about the Pixel 2 was the live Google Translate function. I just, as a huge fan of, you know, like all of the books that we think of when we think of live translation as a technology, I think that was the thing that most interested me about the Pixel 2. And I think, again, Google's software power. I was driving in the car yesterday with my brother and kind of like showing off to him Google's assistant. And he said to me, he was like, wow, Google's pretty good. And I was like, yeah, obviously. And he was like, Siri sucks. And again, I'm not going to come out too hard against Siri and against Apple, but I do think that, like, at least with the Pixel 2, at least this live translate function and basically Google being able to show off its software power in its device was the most interesting thing to me. So I'm sort of intrigued to see what they release with the Pixel 3. And as long as it's got a headphone jack, maybe they'll go back to the headphone jack, I'm hoping. Then I will definitely buy into the Pixel 3.
If you can find somebody who thinks Siri is awesome, by the way, let me know who that person is. I'd love to talk to them. So many Android phones have picked up on the Notch design language / compromise from Apple. And the pictures that I see of the Pixel 3, it's just got a little bezel at top and bottom, and they're not going with the indentation. Is that right? Is that your understanding, Andy?
Yeah, that's not understanding. That's the photo that we've seen.
Literally, yes. I checked the back of the cab.
Sold Adel. Yeah. So, I don't feel as though that marks this phone as unclean and untouchable.
No, I think it's kind of bold that they're like, yeah, we don't need to do a notch. We're not going to do that. It's just everybody else does it. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, I think that edge to edge is really a design thing. It does let you put a larger display in the same size device, but it's not as though I'm suddenly going to be able to like read 2-page comic book spreads in Comixology because I've got a notched screen, is it? So it's fine. I just think it's silly when people say, "Oh my God, look how big that notch is! Oh, the notch! Oh, that's like I need to hold a martini glass and put on a monocle so it's so that monocle could fall theatrically into the martini glass." I think. And for me, I am anticipating buying a Pixel 3 because I do like the size. I love my Pixel 1, which I actually bought a year later.
Such a good piece of hardware. I just picked one up because I like to have a current Android version reference hardware. And my old Pixel or my old Nexus 5X doesn't run Pi. And it's really nice hardware. Very nice.
It's a nice phone. It also has a great camera, which again, if you take, at least me, that's 80% of what I do with my phone is take pictures. And I think, you know, just having an amazing camera is huge in the Pixel 1. And I, you know, again, like if they come out with hardware that is as good as the Pixel 1 and has a headphone jack, I'm in.
Bree, are you allowing any Android in your campaign at all, or that is a no-go?
Well, I mean, I have a pile of Android phones in, you know, our game studio office. I mean, we worked on developing games for Android, and, you know, obviously running for Congress, there's not as much time to develop games as I would like, but I don't have any, like, philosophical objection to Android. It's just, it's literally, like, this is not a situation where you want to be hacked, right? You're talking about some really important stuff, and... Yeah, I really have always been confused that the Pixel is not the most popular Android phone. I mean, I like the Samsung phones that they put out. I think the Touch, the Note 9 this year is particularly great. But I think if you're comparing like the flagship Samsung to the flagship Google, it's generally better. That said, I'm looking at this phone this year, and I don't think it's really progressing as much as I think the iPhone 10 has. I'm a big believer in the fingerprint on the back of the phone. I think it's more convenient if you get used to it, even though I love Face ID. But like, I'd love to see, I just don't see Android, I don't see Google rather putting out Pixel that makes me go, oh, wow, I want to get that. That really looks sexy. That really looks like a cool design. That looks substantially thinner or different or better battery. I don't see that this year. And that's disappointing because I don't want it to be just a, you know, a Samsung and Apple world where only two people are putting out good phones.
Yeah, no, I absolutely see that. My excitement about the Pixel 3 is because I love what Android is doing. What Google is doing with Android, and I really want to have a phone that'll be able to that's designed with next year's Android and the Android after that in mind. I think that Android P this year has got to be one of my favorite updates from last year's to this year's OS on any platform whatsoever. And that's the thing that gets me really excited about staying as an Android user. But you're right. I think that the current generation hardware and what we think is going to be next generation's hardware, it's very, very nice. And it's great for people like me who are only going to be looking at the phone until I get that shipment from Spec and I put it in that grippy case that I like all the time.
Can I ask a question? Like, why does Google why does Google suck at selling hardware? It seems like, or maybe they don't suck, but it just seems like people, I also wonder why the Pixel is not way more popular than it is. And I've always felt like the hardware that Google is putting out is basically like an experiment for them to learn new things to make their software better or something. Like I've never been convinced that Google is serious about hardware. And maybe I'm completely wrong on that and happy to be told I'm wrong, but it just seems like the stuff that they put out that I have bought is great, but they don't, I don't know. I do wonder because some of the hardware is like amazing, but it just doesn't seem to gain the same traction as Apple hardware, and maybe it never will. But even it seems even behind Samsung and these other companies that make like great phones and great devices as well. But I'm just sort of surprised, I guess, that Google's hardware is not more popular than it is.
I mean, I've heard people say, and the chat room is saying it now, is that carriers is a big part of that,
yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
They're not, yeah. They don't have the deals with the carriers.
Yeah, I think it's that, and plus simple marketing. When Samsung comes out with a new phone, I mean, my metric for marketing is when my commuter train pulls into South Station, because Samsung will buy out the entire every space and every platform and every advertising screen inside South Station, and you see them everywhere. And it's not a coincidence. That's the reason why Samsung is kind of the default phone, the default hardware platform for Android, and because they are in every single carrier store. There are people.
But that's
who
what's weird. Like, why don't they spend that money? Like, they have the money, so why don't they spend the money on it?
The other question is, do they have the capability of manufacturing that many phones, which I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's like Apple. I think they'd have to go get a foothold at the mall, just like Microsoft did. It's an analogy here, but Microsoft has really started to excel at hardware. I bought the Microsoft Surface Go, which I think it's an exceptional product. Like from a hardware perspective, I think the software itself has a lot of issues, but the hardware itself is excellent.
Yeah.
You know, Apple went to the mall for the first few years of the Microsoft store being there. It was a ghost town. And I don't know what yours are like, but when I've been to the one in Burlington or the one in Natick, you know, it's a generally popular store these days. I think Microsoft rather has put the time in and they've really built up a following. I think if you look at the Google Pixel Book, I've looked at, like, I've wanted to buy one of the first gen ones for years and just like hack it to run Linux, which is a completely awesome computer if you can do it. But they sold so few of them, it's still unbelievably expensive to find a really good one. So I think they can clearly do it. As far as the number of phones, I think they have the partners out there, which they've used to produce it. I think it's just simply a matter of marketing and having like the in front, like consumer facing places to go sell it.
For the record, my Microsoft store, the last time I went in to buy an Xbox, which was about a month ago, had more people in it than I've ever seen in the Microsoft store. That said, it was all kids playing Fortnite. But there were more of them. Yeah. There were
understandable.
More of them.
That's a good game.
Yeah. And they realized, and I think smart on the Microsoft store's part, they're like, yeah, sure, kids. Come on in. Yeah. Play Fortnite here.
Oh, that shows you how brilliant and profound the decisions, the planning that went around the Apple stores are. They really are town squares where people just go there to hang out, or people go there to get a class and figure out what's going on. My Microsoft store is at the Prudential Center, actually kind of like one street away, almost across the street from the Apple store. And it's usually pretty busy, but there's really no, it really doesn't invite you to sit down at a big, big, huge table and just plop your laptop down and hork on the free Wi-Fi for as long as you want. It really is a place to go buy something, have a nice conversation with somebody in a very clean polo shirt, and then conclude your business and leave.
Well, that store is particularly, like, that's a zoo. Like, if you live in Boston, you know, to avoid that store.
Who among us does not know that? Oh, that's me. I don't know that because I am not from Boston. One other Google-related thing that I wanted to talk about before the next break, which is YouTube, owned by Google, obviously, rolled out the next step. Obviously, at I.O., they talked about digital well-being and the idea that you're trying to manage how you use technology. They rolled out a new time-watched stat this week in their apps that will actually tell you whether you have to look. If you don't want to know, don't look. How much time you spent in today, yesterday, and in the last week on average watching YouTube. Now, I thought about this and thought, my son, I wonder if my son could break 24 hours. Like, if you could literally have like two screens up, and on average, you watch YouTube for 27 hours a day. He could do it. He could do it. But, I think this is a really interesting trend where the, you know, seeing how much time you spend on YouTube is probably not going to encourage you to watch more YouTube, right? It's probably going to encourage you to be like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And yet they are adding this feature, which I think they're to be applauded to do it, because I think a lot of us are going to look at that time number and be like, oh my God, I had no idea I was watching.
Did you do it?
I
saw that. I do want to say, though, my primary use of YouTube is I pay for YouTube Premium. And it's been my experience when you're out about, like streaming YouTube audio really doesn't hurt your data plan that much. It doesn't seem to be any worse than like streaming music. So like when you're running for office, you're in the car constantly driving from place to place. And I love that I can go into the app and can see whatever horrible thing is going on in the news I need to be able to understand and can listen to it while I'm driving. So my stat was amazingly like 4 hours, like on average a day, which I was stunned by. But it's like, I don't think I'm the only person that quote unquote watches YouTube by mostly being in the background when I'm doing something else. I mean, totally. That's not just me, right?
No, that's, my son is literally playing a video game while listening to a YouTube video he occasionally looks at. In fact, I would wager that people who watch Twit probably aren't sitting there with us on their big screen TV. Hi, if you are. And like rapt attention at the four talking heads for 2 hours. My guess is they're doing other stuff and we're up in the corner of their screen and they glance over when they're like, who said that? And then, oh, it's that
guy. How could you, Jason? How could you?
That's my theory. It seems to be, YouTube is not necessarily for super focused attention viewing necessarily.
Right. I didn't have to shave for this?
You did. There's a dress code. You can tell from my t-shirt.
Okay, that's right.
There's a dress code.
So it's like that stat in like my Destiny stat that shows how many hours I've wasted playing Destiny. I'm ashamed of that stat. I'm deeply ashamed
of
that.
Any Steam game will tell you like, oh boy, that much? Right. Really?
Yeah. But this is one I don't know. It's like, would we shame somebody for how many hours you spend listening to the radio? I just don't think it's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's weird too. Like, I wonder how many. Like, I guess I'm curious about, and I don't know. Maybe people were writing about this, but I'm curious about what science they base that on, right? Like, I think it is. I do think it's admirable that they put out that information, and there's sort of this tech wellness thing that's happening, and people are talking about it. And I do think that that's good to be sort of conscious of the amount of time you are spending using these services. But at the same time, like where point me to the science. Like anecdotally, I totally can relate. I mean, I was going to say Shadows of Mordor for me. Like when I looked at the number of hours that I was playing that game, I like almost threw the controller at the television. I was like, oh my God. But I just wonder, I am curious, Jason, you know, you talked about the possibility of like, of that actually getting people to stop. Or to be more conscious of their viewing habits. And I am curious as to where, like, is Google actually like looking at science or studies and saying, oh yeah, this will like get people to be more healthy with their viewing habits? Or are they saying, hey, if we put this stat up, people will think that we are encouraging people to be more healthy with their viewing habits, when in reality, it makes no difference whatsoever.
I just think it's an easy enough thing for them to do. I think that all these services are coming under a certain level of heat about having an impact on lives, but no one knows exactly how good or bad that impact is. I keep coming back to it's an easy enough thing for them to do. And given that they have that, it's essentially an extension of the same sort of stat tracking that they've got going on Android phones now with how much time are you spending in certain apps. I think it's a natural progression and a good thing. What I would love to see is if they were to open up that API so that if someone who does have access to good science wants to build tools to be a more efficient meter on how you're using these devices and use that, harness that data for your personal well-being as opposed to Google's advertising well-being. There are a lot of things that you could, I wouldn't say diagnose, but it's interesting data. There have been times where I've looked back on it felt like I wasn't getting out enough. It felt like, and that might be because my mood is bad or something like that. And I went into that tab in Google where it will say, well, here's a calendar of like where you went on certain places. And I could see, oh, wow, that's right. In December, like I didn't really even leave the house for 2 days. And then I went out like once just around the block to do some shopping. And then I didn't leave the house for another 2 days. It would be great to have the ability to take a look at that stats to not even do something as simple as, gosh, I seem to be spending too much time watching YouTube. But when you're trying to figure out the status of your well-being, and that could be just as simple as, hey, I want to live a happier, more productive life. Or it might be that I deal with major depression and I need to figure out when I seem to be cocooning as opposed to engaging with the world. And did these periods of just spending instead of 2 or 3 hours watching YouTube to now like 8 or 9 hours in Netflix and 8 or 9 hours in this app, did that coincide with something else that I could look at and track? It's good to have that data available, and I don't see any particular downside to it.
I know why you didn't go out in December, Andy. It's New England weather, am I right? Yay. See, again, I don't know what I'm talking about there.
But that's right.
That was
good.
That's when you get out the tobogganing.
I don't know. I see people liken it to calorie counts, whether you're counting calories yourself or it's being displayed in the restaurant. Look, you can ignore it or you can pay attention to it. It depends on what you want to do. It gives people the option. I like the idea that people can choose to be aware of what they're doing if they want to make a change in their life. I also am dreading the fact that in maybe 3 weeks, iOS 12 is going to come out. And at some point in the weeks following that, we will be barraged with thousands of think pieces by everybody who's using the new screen time feature, which will be able to say, yes, you are using social media 10 hours a day. I think it will make people make changes in their life habits that will make their lives better. I do believe that. But boy, there are going to be so many people who are going to be like writing that very serious, I needed to regroup in my real life after discovering how much time I played X or was on this site using screen time. It's going to happen. Get ready for it. It's happening.
I'm ready for it being gamified. I want, like, just on my Apple Watch, I want to get this little like Chrome badge. Like, you just earned your 8-hour Arrested Development badge from one day.
I'm challenging you. Which one of us can use social media the least in the next week?
Oh my goodness.
maybe they'll get there.
I want to counter for the time I've spent reading think pieces. I feel like I
Oh my God. No, that's something the New York Times will never give you is the think piece counter.
Ladies and gentlemen, if it weren't for think pieces, I would not be paying my cable bill every month. So I will not have you malign think pieces.
It's true. As somebody
writes, they don't require me to think or research.
That's right. No thinking required for a think piece. You do the thinking by reading it. I don't do the thinking by writing it. What are you talking about? All right. I feel a strong sense that someone who's floating in the Mediterranean needs to tell us something about something. And that person is, I don't know, it's probably Leo Laporte. Let's see.
Hi, Jason and gang. Thank you for letting me interrupt. I'm on vacation right now, but I bet you, I'm not sure, but I bet you I'm missing my Casper. Oh, it's such a good feeling, isn't it, when you go home after a hard day and you pull back the sheets, you get under the covers, and you just go, And I get that every night. In fact, it is a little hard to travel because I don't know what I'm going to get. But I know when I get home, I'm going to say, oh, it's so good to be home with my Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. They noticed there was this real discontinuity in the economics of the mattress business. Turns out that there's this horrendous markup at the mattress showrooms. And by selling direct to you, by manufacturing and selling direct to you, Casper saves so much money. And then they pass that on directly to you. Brilliant. And man, talk about brilliant. Casper's mattress, obsessively engineered at a fair price, made in the USA. Their expert team of engineers and designers researched, prototyped, tests. They made hundreds of test models. They wanted to meet the needs of all kinds of sleepers and give you just the perfect balance of both support and comfort. So when you get in bed, you go, oh, I love my my Casper. I love my Casper. And all Casper mattresses use premium foams that relieve pressure. No more of that hip poking thing, you know. We're just, oh, ow. It helps align your body so you fall asleep easily. You wake up feeling refreshed. And for me, really important, it breathes. It is, you sleep cool on a Casper. Summer or winter, that's important. Regulating your body temperature turns out to be one of the most important things during sleep. Casper makes it easy. Now, I know summer's coming to an end, so this is a limited time Labor Day offer. Say goodbye to summer by taking advantage of Casper's limited time Labor Day offer. Get 10% off any order with a mattress by visiting casper.com/savings. That is really a good deal. 10% off any order as long as there's a mattress in it. So you can order some other stuff too. Casper.com/savings. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. You actually have 100 days or 100 nights, I should say, to sleep on your Casper. If at any time you say, no, it's not for me, you call them. They come and get it. Refund every penny, cost you nothing. But you won't. In fact, probably like me, you're going to say, I can't wait to get home from vacation so I can sleep on my Casper. Free shipping and returns, U.S. and Canada. For a limited time, 10% off any order with a mattress by visiting casper.com/savings. This offer expires September 3rd, 2018. I hope you heard this in time. Terms and conditions apply. 10% off any order with a mattress, but you've got to do it right now because the offer expires September 3rd. Casper.com/savings. Now back to you, Jason.
Thank you, Leo. One of the signs of a true media professional, by the way, is that when I'm on the show, I'm getting very excited and I'm going to talk and I'm going to say, we're going to talk about this topic and I'm going to talk really fast. And then we cut to Leo and he's just happy to be as slow as he needs to be talking about a mattress. I aspire to that level of chill on podcasts. I don't have it yet.
It is,
I aspire. I dream.
Kitty. It's the cat. It's the cat. The cat helps.
It's true. It's true. So definitely, Leo is an aspirational figure. Okay, this is the topic that I don't really want to talk about because it pains me, but I feel like we need to talk about it because this week, the president of the United States said that Google is out to get him. It's rigging its search results against him. The search results are very biased, that they didn't promote his State of the Union address, which wasn't really true, that it was all unfair, and Google is a meanie, and it's out to get the president of the United States, and we're taking a look. Maybe something can be done about Google.
Man, I wish Google did that.
Google's falling down on the job, you're saying. I feel like I want to ask Brianna Wu about this one. Is Google and the internet out to get the president of the United States? Is that what's happening now?
So I'm afraid I may have a different opinion than some of the people here today. So with Trump, no, it's not. It's clearly not. I mean, if you Google Trump's name, and I did before the show, it's linking to reputable search results. It is showing accurately what credible media sources seem to be thinking about him. That said, I do think there is an adult discussion to be had about the way that Google ranks things. One of the things I've really faced in my career is this week I did a piece with Kotaku, I did Wall Street Journal, I did New York Times. You know, there's a lot of credible media sources about me that don't always say things that I like, but it's fair, it's accurate, it's well-researched, it's journalism. Then at the same time, it feels like stuff from very wholly unreputable sites ends up in the search results of a lot of marginalized people's search results. Like, I dare you to Google any professional woman in the entire world and see what comes up in her search results. It's going to be Reddit, you know, it's going to be, 4chan. It's going to be all these sites that don't really add anything to the conversation. What I've been trying to talk to Google about for years now, in back channel, is talking to them about the way that they rank things, because people click on dirt and dirt does make things go higher and higher in the rankings. And I don't have any issue with that being out there and being publicly searchable. Like, this is the magic of the internet. But I do think there's a discussion to be had about how people like to click on dirt. We like to click on clickbait. That's why that media model works. And maybe when it comes to like search results about topics, we should be thinking about ranking New York Times, Washington Post, these really excellent sources of journalism higher than they are.
I totally, for the record, I totally agree with you, Brianna. I think that I think that this is a bigger conversation, and as much as I will say that I'm totally fine with like not seeing any more news, period, some days. I do think that this is a bigger conversation. Obviously, Facebook has struggled with this. Twitter has struggled with this. All of the major platforms that we use every day are trying to solve this curation question, and mostly trying to solve it for their own profitability and for their users, right? But I also think it's really tricky when you start to get into this conversation of, well, what news sources should we promote? And I think that's part of the reason that a lot of the executives at these companies resist this idea, because I do think that that is a tricky conversation of saying like, okay, well, let's make sure people get their vegetables, right? And obviously it is, they are designing their tools around how users act and user behavior, and they're trying to serve the user the content that the user seems to want. And if the user clicks on trash, they get served more trash. And I do think that that's a really complicated thing of figuring out how to give people news, how to give people their vegetables, for lack of a better term. So I agree that I think it is a conversation worth having. I also think, and I think we've talked about this on this show before, that that you really need a human element in this curation process. It's not going to work to just build some algorithmic solution to this. You need a human element when you're talking about fake news, or you're talking about like wrong news or bad news or whatever. So I do think it's a bigger conversation. I do think that the president is not wrong that there may be issues with the larger question of curation on tech platforms, and we need to know more about how they do it. And they probably need to do more to make sure they don't do it in an irresponsible way, since they have now become the arbiters of how we take in information all the time. But when it comes to his positive stories getting punished, I think it's complete BS.
Yep. I just want to say one more very quick thing here. Let's be clear that there has been throughout my life a very concerted effort by one particular political party to work the refs. We saw this with the coverage of Facebook and the stories that came out this week about people not feeling they could express conservative opinions at Facebook. That's part of a whole tactic that's been very, very effective. So, I think there's a conversation that needs to happen here, but let's be really clear. Like, a certain political party is trying to work the referees here and get an outcome in their favor.
Andy, what are you thinking?
A couple of things here. Google's not responsible if people are writing about really weird and contrary things that you're saying, and Google search finds all those articles. Yeah, that's not Google's problem, and that's your problem. It's the problem of the people who are paid very, very well, government salaries, to make sure to try to get you not to say stupid and contrary and incorrect things. But it's good to have that broader question. You're right about prejudice and search. I don't believe there's a liberal prejudice or conservative prejudice. There is, as Bree mentioned, when you do these searches, you get it seems to be favoring major news outlets that have real journalism that's happening, as opposed to Kyle and Randy's political blog. But that in itself does point out one prejudice that we're not aware of, that independent voices of journalism are not going to be favored it's always going to be large corporate owned newspapers and media outlets that are going to get the most attention. It's not wrong that the New York Times becomes a juggernaut in these search results, but not not everybody is as well funded as the New York Times, even though they're working just as hard and providing just as good journalism. And the other thing is that Google is not necessarily in control of its own algorithm, and they don't know how it works and what effects it has on the people who are doing the searches until somebody there's a really great book that I got a hold of earlier this year. I had to go look it up. Algorithms of Oppression by Jackie Snow. And it's basically about how Google search can enforce racism. She did the inciting idea from this book was she did a search for black girls wanting to find some pieces that her nieces would enjoy, but that might find interesting. And most of the first pages were links to model sites and porn sites. And that was a prejudice that was built into the search engine because the people who are gaming this are trying to hardwire those pages for those two words. But nonetheless, the majority of people who are just looking for, I'm doing a history paper, or I want to find out what resources there are for black girls who want to code or black girls who want to get access to whatever. And that's not something that you get when you do other similar search terms. So I don't know that it's a problem that Google can very easily solve. The Boston Globe had a very, very long piece earlier this year that they posited that it's time for Google to be broken up, in that they made the case that, for one thing, Google should open up the search algorithm so everyone can see how that works, which is a natural solution to the problem of we have to find out what's inside this black box. But the problem is, once everyone knows how it works, everybody will figure out how to fool it, and that can't happen. What I really favor is it is a black box, but it's a black box we all have access to. Researchers can send whatever signals that come into it, take a look at the signals that come out of it, and point out where it's failing. And so I don't know if this had any direct if the book that I was mentioning had any direct impact like this. But now if you do search for black girls, there's almost nothing that isn't a LinkedIn profile for black girls coding programs and other positive and good things. So long as we have the if Google is not going to monitor this, we have the ability to monitor it and make sure that it's not having an effect on our perception of the world.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing before we move on this?
Sure.
So at the height of Gamergate back in 2014, I got a rather interesting email from a woman, and she was describing to me a company that a man in tech had started to basically wage SEO warfare against women that he didn't like. And the idea was, if you broke up with a girl or had some problem with the woman at work, you could destroy her life. And he had a set of bot farms that would essentially go and rank up anything that the person paying for it wanted in a person's search results to basically destroy this person's professional reputation. It was shocking to me how little that cost. Andy, one of the things in the example you just mentioned, if they do open up that box, that's going to be a roadmap for people to know exactly how to conduct SEO warfare. So I'm not sure that I agree with that. But I would say SEO warfare as a tactic, this has implications for cybersecurity. It has implications for national security. This is information warfare. And we do need to start to have a discussion about this. Now, I'm not the kind of person where I believe every single problem needs to be solved by the government, but I do think that there needs to be a conversation between national security interests and Google to make sure that other people aren't gaming search results for nefarious purposes. And I do think that's a conversation we should start to have.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I have a fear, but that fear shouldn't interfere with this conversation that we need to have. My fear is that we've seen what happens when people who decide that it's wrong that science doesn't our science textbooks in schools don't cover intelligent design. We need a balanced discussion of it. And if we're looking at the scientific portion of it, and it's not balanced unless we look at the other one. So my fear, and again, I don't think this fear should supersede the ongoing conversation into how best to integrate search into responsibility for positive search into society. My fear is that someone will say, "Well, look, if someone is saying did Andy Anatko, who's running for Congress, actually steer all of his campaign money into cookies and beer?" if there are 41 articles to say, well, I don't know what that rumor is about, but
I want to vote for him, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I should stress that I'm on the record of saying no, I'm not even running for office. But it's like, well, it's not a balanced search unless there are also 40. It also pulls up 41 articles that says that he did do it. It's like, well, no, because these are idiots who are saying that he did that thing. He's not even running for office.
I think your statement cuts to the core of a lot of the president's complaints too, which is we live in an era where people talk about alternative facts and truth not being truth. And one of the challenges is if you're trying to create this concept of a neutral search engine, but nobody can agree what neutral is. And you see the arguments around this story. It's things like, how dare that you say that CNN is neutral and Breitbart isn't? And it's like, okay, well, you know, that is a perspective. And somebody else might say, how could you say that Fox News is neutral and CNN isn't? And when you can't agree on like what reality is, it's a problem now, not necessarily to people who know all the brand names and know that when they pull up a Google News search and they see a Breitbart article, they know what they're going to get versus a ShareBlue article, let's say. But it does matter if it's a topic where somebody is innocently typing something into the internet wanting to know what the truth is, and what they get is not the truth, but they get this weird collection of potentially like, is the earth flat, right? The answer is no, it's not. And it's not fair and balanced and neutral.
Wait.
Oh, boy.
Wait. The answer is what?
I got some news for you later about the ice wall in Antarctica. Yeah. Anyway, you know, that's the danger there is when people are saying, well, yeah, but I just want to know the real truth on the internet. And if the internet is incapable of providing the truth because we're unwilling to say this is true and this is not. But when we can't agree on the truth, that's a lot harder.
Yeah. Well, just to one point of clarification that we shouldn't care whether a news source is biased or not. We can only hold them to the standard that they have to say things that are factually based. They can, if it's not labeled as a personal editorial, if they're saying you're free to say that the world is flat, but you have to show your work. If you've done an incredible amount of research and if you've done all the homework and shown all the math, that's okay. If you're just saying a guess, citing other BS blogs that don't have any firmament. That's why bias is such a bad word for journalism. I don't know any journalist who isn't biased in some way. But if they are journalists, they know that they can't simply say that employment is way down under Trump. Well, no, it isn't. You would have to come up with numbers to, if you wanted. You don't start off with the idea, I'm going to write about how the employment is down under Trump. You write under, well, how is employment doing under Trump? And then when you find out that no, the numbers are actually very, very good, you bite your tongue, you swallow your bile, and you say, well, employment is actually very, very good under Trump, because that's what you can actually prove. So bias is not as important as being an actual journalist.
Yeah,
it's hard stuff, complicated. Turns out when we were all excited about inventing the internet, I don't know. I was on the internet in the late 80s, and I feel like sometimes those of us who were there early, the computer nerds among us, we probably got a sense at that point like, oh, wow, imagine if all the issues we have now on this small internet were taken where everybody in the entire world was on the internet. Oh, that might be bad. That might be bad. That might be bad for society. Turns out, well, what you gonna do? Here we are. Now everybody's on the internet, and we've come a long way in 30 years is what I'm saying. I do sense another disturbance in the force, as if somebody concerned about our own personal security on the internet was floating in the Mediterranean and had sent us a message in a bottle that we need to know about. Leo?
Let me barge in one more time and talk a little bit about something we did at Twit that made a huge difference, certainly in peace of mind for me. It all started when we had an engineer who couldn't remember the passwords, right? Now, most people, if they can't remember passwords, they'll put a post-it note on the screen, they'll write it down in a book, they'll do something. He did, I think he thought he was clever. He put it up on the internet, on a public website. All the logins, all the passwords for our web servers, our Amazon instance, everything on a public website. That's when I said, no, there's got to be a better way, and we got LastPass Enterprise. It turns out I'd been using LastPass for years. LastPass celebrated its 10th anniversary last month. Oh, actually in July, so that's almost 2 months now. And I started using them, I think, right about when they first started. And then we got to know Joe Segrist, the creator of LastPass. Steve Gibson interviewed him. Steve looked at the source code. He gave it thumbs up. He started using it. So I know LastPass is great. It's a password vault, keeps track of your passwords. It's the last password you have to remember, the LastPass vault password. But it has so many features for enterprise that are so important. Remember, when you have employees and you're giving them the keys to the kingdom, you know, they're going to leave. They can share those passwords. I just saw a study that said 32% of employees share their passwords with other employees or people, maybe not even employees. Now, ooh, ow. And then there's always the guy who's going to put it on the public website. LastPass Enterprise makes password sharing convenient for employees, but keeps access to corporate data secure. You can completely customize the access. I can share a password with an employee, and they don't even get the password. They can't share it. They don't have it. They can use it, but they don't have it. I set it whether they can modify it. There are 100 different policies, things like, we have master password requirements, so they can't use Monkey123 to open their vault. They have to use a good password. We do have password resets, so if they forget, an administrator, I or Russell or somebody can reset it. We do require, and I would recommend this, two-factor. In fact, LastPass's authenticator app makes it really easy. It's not a number. A button pops up on your employee's phone and said, did you just try to log in? And they say, yes, that guarantees they're the only ones who can access their account. That, I think, is really good. You can organize more than just passwords, too. Database logins, SSH keys, software licenses. You know, as I travel, I'm in Europe right now. I always have in my LastPass an image of my passport. So I always have it with me. You don't want to put that on a public website, but I always have it with me, secure, plus credit cards, driver's license, everything, social security numbers. I store it all in LastPass. And LastPass makes it easy if an employee leaves to restrict access. Or maybe they just no longer need access to the QuickBooks or whatever. You can easily change that. LastPass now supports Active Directory too, by the way. So you can use your Active Directory credentials to log in. So if you're an Active Directory house, that's a great feature. You don't have to even have a LastPass password. Just use your AD credentials. And of course, and this is important, this is one of the things that Steve Gibson wanted to see, data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is secret even from LastPass. No one has access to it but you. LastPass is a password generator. It's great. I use it all the time. And you know what I do? A little tip. I make passwords of very varying lengths. So sometimes I was just on a site that said you can't make it more than 12. I was like, come on. But if I can use long passwords and I use the longest ones I can, but let's say it's, we allow 48. I'll use 47 or 42. So it's not easily guessed how long my password is. Makes it really easy to do that. You can, of course, have letters, numbers, special characters, whatever you need. So there's LastPass for Business. That's the LastPass Enterprise. If you have a small business, LastPass Teams, 50 or fewer, that's good. There's LastPass Premium for your own personal use if you're not already using it. Why not? LastPass Families is great, too. That's what I use at home. That way I can share passwords with Lisa. To like things like, you know, she wants to know I need to know what the login for Comcast is. I could send that to her. Securely. LastPass. More than 13 million people trust LastPass. It's the number one most preferred password manager. So what I've been using for almost a decade, Steve Gibson uses, and we use here at TWIT. Enough said, right? LastPass. Learn more at LastPass.com/TWIT. LastPass.com/TWIT.
Snell?
Yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. I'm coming, sir. I'm here. What is it? Oh, he's not going to answer, is he? He's probably not going to answer. By the way, great news from our chat room and our live video stream. They all assure us that they watch it all in full screen and they are always paying attention to everything we do. We're not minimized. They are very special people. They are wrapped with attention for this everything we're doing.
Really? Well, yeah. I'm surprised at that time during the last ad break before it, when I was holding up that sign that says everybody in the chat room can suck eggs, that nobody mentioned that.
Nobody said a single thing. They didn't mention anything when you put on that chicken costume earlier. Nothing.
I guess just water off a duck's back. You just cannot be, your elan cannot be dampened. Okay. No,
I just love how dedicated they are. So we live in a world where people say everything is a service. I was reading a story about how one could argue that Apple's focus on services revenue should start to include iPhone revenue, since you can actually sign up for a plan where you just get a new iPhone every year by paying them a monthly fee. And all of this is my way of saying Microsoft announced a new thing called Xbox All Access. And ooh, what is this? You get, and this is right after I bought an Xbox One X, by the way, so I was really thrilled to see this news. You get Xbox Game Pass, where you've got like more than 100 games that you have access to. You get Xbox Live Gold, which gives you access to a whole bunch of extra stuff too. And either an Xbox One S console or an Xbox One X console. If you want the One S, which is the cheaper one, it's $22 a month on a 2-year contract. If you want the One X, it's $35 a month. So they've rolled all of their premium services and the box itself into a 2-year contract with a monthly fee, and Xbox as a service is here, I guess. You don't need to buy the console. You just pay them $22 or $35 a month, and you got an Xbox with all the games that are on their services, like, right then, including, I think it's all of the exclusives go into Game Pass, all the Xbox exclusives, of which there are not as many as on PlayStation. But still, Bree, I know you're a huge gamer. What do you think about...
I used to be before I was running for office. Running.
Okay, well, you know, okay, think back. How you feel about this idea of the console maker just saying, sure, just pay us monthly and we'll give you the box?
So I think this is a fantastic deal for consumers. I think this is an amazing deal for consumers. That said, people don't understand just how expensive games are to develop. You know, something like Netflix works because the cost of developing content has really, really gone down. Like the cost of delivering special effects, the cost of doing color correction, it's gone down to a point where they can do that for Netflix shows. For game development, what you're seeing is we haven't really found a way to bring those costs down. And this has led to a real innovation crisis in our industry, where if people are, you know, spending $150 million to make a game, well, that's why we're getting Call of Duty Black Ops 3 this year. So I think this is a great deal. I'm definitely going to subscribe to it. That said, I think this is going to send our industry into... once this becomes mainstream, I don't think this is going to be good for developers at all. I'm not going to talk out of school, but I think if you talk to most developers that have participated in PlayStation Plus and the free games that come along with that, it has been a very mixed bag whether or not that's been a financially good deal for them. Often they'll just give you like $30,000, $40,000 to like basically have the game on the service forever, which isn't great for a lot of people. It doesn't recoup costs. So, gay for consumers, really bad for our industry, and it's just going to make our innovation crisis that much worse.
I will say, knowing some people in the VFX industry, I think there are some similar issues there, where the price of visual effects has been pushed down, but also the job security and the payment to those people, and it's the most important thing in movies and TV today, and yet they have very little power, and a lot of those companies go out of business, just like game studios do. It's actually there are some parallels there, too. Ben and Andy, what do you guys think about Microsoft as a Xbox as a service? It's a thing now. Just pay a month and you get a game and you get a console.
It's crazy. It reminds me of cell phones, right? Like,
yeah, it is. It's your Xbox plan, your monthly Xbox plan.
Yeah, and I don't know. There is something compelling about the idea of not necessarily having to buy a new console every 5 years or whatever the heck it is for $400. And for some reason, even though I might eventually pay more than that, paying a monthly fee instead feels better somehow. I do think it's an interesting idea. The question is, I don't know, how many people will jump onto it and how many people will be like me, where they really just want to like buy the thing and own the thing. And you know, this is another old man grumbling thing, I guess, but I spend a lot of my time complaining about like how you used to own the game. You bought the game and it came on a DVD and you owned that thing, or you owned the software. It came on a actual physical thing that you owned a copy of it. And now this move to everything as a internet-based service, there are things about that where you're just kind of borrowing it. Everything from when we're talking about digital music to software to games becomes, I think, frustrating in a lot of ways, to say nothing of the impact it has on the actual people whose jobs it is to make this stuff. I think it does actually, you know, create some annoyances for the user that you wouldn't have imagined before when you were so excited about how convenient it was.
Mm. Well, it is nice that you do, after spending like what, $600 to $800, you do get to keep the console at the end of the agreement. That's nice. My big reaction is that this really shows you how valuable customer acquisition is for any service. That if you can get now, and I think it's especially a big problem for a lot of players now that every TV comes with a Netflix client and a Hulu client and a YouTube client built in. If you can somehow get more people to lock to basically choose your box as the pipe through which all of their content comes, boy, you can't. That's the hose that sucks money out of their bank account. Because at some point they're going to buy stuff, and at some point they are going to forget to turn off certain controls that let you observe exactly how they're playing and what they're watching. That's why it's such a good example to compare this to early days of phones, where they would give you the phone if you just sign up. Because the most important thing is if they can get you to sign up for 2 years to use AT&T or to use Verizon, chances are you're going to still be a customer 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, no matter how you abuse them. So that's a sign of exactly how the streaming world is going, and it shows you how things might change in the next year or two if Apple does decide to deliver a streaming package through Apple TV, or if Google just does decide to expand their YouTube TV service to become your point of access to pretty much every piece of streamed entertainment that you might want to access. So this is going to be cheap money. This is going to be long money for Microsoft, I think.
And from a purely consumer buying psychology standpoint, the fact is, a smaller monthly bill seems better than having to go over that hurdle of spending $400 or $300 on a console, even though if you net it out over 2 years, you're spending a lot of money on all of this stuff, but you don't have to put down a large sum of money. It's just like buying a $1,000 phone. It's a lot easier to agree to a 2-year contract for a small, you know, a 2-digit sum instead of shelling out a lot of money, but you're still spending the money is the thing.
Yeah, this sort of deal does tend to bring in a lot more people of middle and lower income, because they can get a hold of $35 over the course of a month. They might not necessarily be able to get a hold of $500 all at once, particularly when they know that they're handing over $500 and getting a game console. So this is why biases in pricing tends to really have a long impact. There's the old saying that, you know, there's nothing more expensive than a cheap pair of boots, because these $100 boots you're going to have to replace in a year, whereas if you buy a pair of $500 boots, they'll last you 100, they'll last you 10, 15, 20 years. But the thing is that a lot of people, they will not have that. They don't have that $500 to spend at once on a pair of boots, but they can get $100. I mean, they need boots right now. So
yeah. Just 19,000 payments of $19.99.
Oh, well, sign me up. Sign me up. Yes, Bree, what would you like to say?
No, I was just going to say, I also think it's worth thinking about the fact that our industry profits so much by re-releasing games to run on modern systems. Ask any gamer how many copies of Final Fantasy VI or Final Fantasy IV they've bought. I probably bought 20 different versions of it for different platforms. I do think this is going to really cut into that revenue. I mean, again, it's great for the consumer, but like, look at Valkyria Chronicles. This is a fantastic example. Sega puts out this game. It's kind of a cult classic, you know, they sell it again to you by selling the PS4, you know, upscale remaster that's essentially just a re-release. And they do very well with that. I think if the service catches on, that's just another way that, again, great for the consumer. Why should I have to buy Valkyria Chronicles again to run on my PS4 when I buy it from my PS3? But not super great for, you know, the people actually making these games.
And there are a lot of games that are not in these subscription services that people can still buy separately. But I've seen it firsthand with my son in our one-month trial of Xbox Game Pass that we got when we bought the One X and with Live Gold, that the fact is the existence of those libraries suppresses his desire to buy other games. So it does have a carry-on effect, and I'm sure it then pressures those developers to get in because now their revenues are down. It pressures their developers to get into these deals, which are bad deals for them. And I can see that. I can see it happening in my house, that he's definitely less interested in buying games because he's got this huge catalog now.
Yeah. So it's even Apple is looking at the problem of if we can't necessarily attain more customers, how can we make more money off of each transaction? And that was one of the highlights of the sales call that analyst call a few months ago, that although iPhone sales are a little bit flat, they're making money, more money with off of every customer. So now Microsoft is kind of doing that same thing where we can grow, we can have customers, but make more money by selling them services, access to old games, as opposed, and as Bree says, it kind of throws a knife in developers' backs. If Microsoft is more concerned with selling subscriptions to Microsoft services than they are helping developers sell games.
I want to shift gears for a minute. One of the other topics I wanted to touch on briefly, is something I noticed this week. It was a report in the Financial Times about Uber. And in specific, it was a conversation that one of the reporters had with Dara Khosrowshahi, who is the CEO of Uber now. And what he said was they are planning a long-term shift from cars to electric bicycles and scooters. And they already bought an e-bike company, Jump, and they have a deal with Lime, the bike and scooter rental system. And what the CEO of Uber said is there are lots of cases, and this is kind of a no-brainer, but to hear the CEO of Uber say it is interesting. There are a lot of cases where you're in an urban core and you need to take one person a few blocks, and there is no reason for that to happen in a car that weighs a ton when you could hop on a little electric scooter and just zip there in a few minutes and not have to deal with gridlock downtown. And I was intrigued by this because it seems to me that if you're an Uber driver, you're like, well, wait a second, that's one of my fares you just took away from me. But I get kind of the larger point, which is that this is a recognition by Uber that maybe as advanced a disruptive technology transportation platform as they are, if all their chips are on cars, they're missing out on the potential of e-bikes and scooters.
Go ahead.
I'll just then be quick. My first reaction is that they're clearly trying. You want to own all the railroads on the monopoly board, and so that's exactly what they're doing. This is going to be the popularity of as much damage as they do these early iterations of these dockless scooter and bicycle rentals. The fact that they're so popular. Last time I was in DC. You see just people riding these things everywhere. That means that it's fulfilling, just like Uber was fulfilling a need that was invisible until this service became available. They can't stand by and let someone else take, again, one of the other railroads on the board when they have the ability to take it themselves.
Ben?
I was going to use a different analogy, which is basically like owning the whole chain, right? Like they want to own everything from planes, trains, automobiles.
Yeah. How far do you want to go? We've got something for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually do as a user, like I do see the potential beauty of that future, right? Like if I'm, it's the same thing. It basically is the same thing as Amazon, but for travel. Right. Like if I'm a Prime Uber member, I just like get out of my car and I get onto my Uber, you know, scooter, and then I, you know, get onto my Uber train. And then, you know what I mean? Like, I think reducing that friction of having to sort of like get the car rental and then do this, like when you're on vacation, for instance, to just be able to like swipe your fob or whatever the heck, just to do everything in your travel schedule or on your itinerary with one company, I think makes a lot of sense. So I can totally see, it makes total sense why Uber would be trying to do this sort of thing.
Bree, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking the exact same thing. I think sometimes when we talk about technology, there tends to be a very American-centric point of view. If you look at China, like they've innovated with rideshare bicycle sharing services and scooter services. So this just seems like an entirely new way to do this. Jason, I was at WWDC this year where I saw your great show on Relay. And
we were riding electric scooters, weren't we? All of us.
I felt bad for my hotel, like getting an Uber to drive down there. Like, it's gorgeous. I'm outside. I'm not having to smile because I'm not running for anything at that moment. And I remember looking at the very bare bicycle sharing surface that was down there and thinking how great that would be if it were more expanded. So I would just, I love this idea and I would love to see it happen. Though I will say there are plenty of times, when you're riding with elderly people, like not everyone can get on a scooter and go that last mile. So I would like for the option to be there for you to just get driven all the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's also another regulation nightmare.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Yep.
It's an absolute, I can't say the other half of this, but it's an absolute cluster.
Yes,
right?
that was my several of my friends at Apple's developer conference in San Jose, where there were Bird and Lime scooters everywhere. We rode the scooters, and they were a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, the general response was, ride them while they're legal, because they should not be legal. They're super dangerous. Because what you need, I went into Amsterdam this summer, and like what you need is you need the city to adjust to the existence of these vehicles. Because right now, one of those scooters, you're supposed to not ride on the sidewalk, which is good because you will plow down pedestrians. That's not good. But if you go in the bike lane, you will die because there will be big cars there that will hit you, and there will be bikes that will be angry at you. So like we all need to adjust our cities to this stuff. But as Andy pointed out, the demand shows you there's something there. There's clearly something there.
That's why I really, really like these dockless vehicles. I think it's super, super important that these companies work with communities as opposed to simply every city go, wow, there's a van driving around just dumping dumping bikes and dumping scooters everywhere.
What could go wrong with that?
Yeah, exactly. They need to. That's why San Francisco decided. Guess what? The two biggest players, because you've been jerks, you don't get to operate in the city.
As it turns out if you ask for forgiveness instead of permission, when you go against the supervisors, they say no, we're not going to give the contract to you. Then,
we don't forgive you. Disrupting. But the reason why I think that we should definitely let these things happen and grow is that because, again, not only because people have demonstrated that we have a use for these are fulfilling a need, it will also help solve so many problems that have hitherto been unsolvable. I've said before in another podcast that I gave up my car a few years ago because my bike was and public transportation were working so well, and this system worked so well that I took only like a portion of the money that I was going to be spending on to replace the car that I gave up a few years ago. It basically, the salt corrosion got to it before I did. That's why I gave up the car. But I've replaced that with now an electric pedal assist bike. And the reason why more people aren't using these electric bicycles and electric scooters is because, as you say, even if a city is advanced enough to put down a bike lane, nobody, the drivers don't care. UPS drivers will still park over that lane as they go, oh, we're just going to drop off a couple packages. And UPS will have a big fit if they start getting ticketed for blocking the bike lane. But once this becomes part of the assumed infrastructure of how people get around, once it's ordinary people who haven't necessarily spent $3,000 on an electric bike, haven't necessarily bought like an electric skateboard, but the people who do count on if they were meeting somebody a mile and a half away, instead of getting a cab or taking public transportation, if they know that I can just grab a scooter and get there without having to walk the whole way, once they start saying, hey, I can't, I've been forced to like go into the street. That's unsafe. I won't have this. Or I've been forced to go on the sidewalk where I'm endangering other people. I won't have this. That's when cities start to see, here's how many people are getting from here to there on personal electric vehicles or personal vehicles. And so we're going to have to make sure that there's infrastructure to accommodate them safely, which, and part of that infrastructure is that, guess what, UPS driver, now you are getting ticketed every time you block that green thing. So it's not just going to help out people who like to use these dockless vehicles, but it's also going to help people who maybe decide that, gee, I use these bicycles so much, maybe I will buy myself a folding bicycle so that I can get from the office to where I need to go from time to time, or people who want to have those electric bikes. So just like AMS, again, you have to develop a city right. That incorporates this stuff, and you have to make sure that you support these people. Once people have support for using these vehicles, more people will use them, and that's how you get more cars out of the city, and all the unnecessary cars out of your city.
Yeah, walking around Amsterdam is just it's great in seeing that is a city that has been redesigned for bicycles being a major part, and it's huge. I wonder about what might happen in a city like that where they actually have bicycle as a service there, where literally like there's so much bike theft that it's better to just pay for a service, and if somebody steals your bike, they just bring you another one. It's like a disposable bike. Interesting. And you mentioned pedal assist. I wanted to say one of the things since Bree especially mentioned accessibility, the idea that can you ride on a scooter? Are you well enough to ride on a scooter, for example? One of the things about e-bikes that's great is that they aren't traditional bikes. They've got the electric assist, which means if you're somebody who isn't comfortable riding up a hill, or you don't want to get super sweaty when you get to the office at the end for your commute because you've had to pedal up a hill, that's what's great about e-bikes, is they're accessible to way more people than who would use a traditional bike where they have to supply all the power themselves, which it's a good thing for transportation. Maybe not as great a workout, but good for transportation in urban areas. Yeah.
But that's
I'm also curious about tech solutions to some of the logistical challenges. Like, could you, if your phone knows what your altitude is and what the temperature is and where you are exactly, can you almost apply some similar technology like solutions to making sure that none of these scooters, for instance, ride on the sidewalk? Like, again, this is a little bit futuristic, I suppose, but can you, as you're designing cities to be more open to these, to multimodal transportation, or however you want to describe it, you should be able to get these companies to make some tech changes to the modes of transportation themselves to make sure that they stay in their lane, for lack of a better term.
Oh goodness. Yeah. I have to say, I obviously think that could be a component of it, but I think the core issue here is we need to start planning our cities for the future. That means funding infrastructure. That means thinking about a future where maybe not everyone has a car. I think here in Massachusetts, that might even, and I know this is an extreme political view, maybe we should fund the T. Maybe, I don't know, but I think like we've got to start funding infrastructures for city and not have like a 4-year plan that we have been having. I think we need like a 20-year plan for what our major cities are going to look like.
Yeah, for sure.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of experimentation going on at the city level, which is interesting because we talk so much about how so much of our government can seem dysfunctional or gridlocked at times. And there are a lot of cities that are trying new things, and sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. But I think that there are some encouraging signs that you do have cities that are embracing these things and saying, sure, let's give it a try and see what happens.
There are whole groups there. It's a whole culture of us. It's actually called City of the Future Planning. And there are a lot of research being done on it, and a lot of like advisory groups that and the Obama administration actually had a lot of people who are very deeply involved in this. I went to a couple of conferences during the last administration that are just mind blowing about, here is what happens once you start to get all the unnecessary cars off the road. Once you start to build, essentially, if it really isn't if you build it, they will come sort of thing. Once you create a thoroughfare that is appealing to, or even just basically safe for pedestrians and self-powered vehicles, people, the more people see people on bicycles and on electric scooters in these lanes going past stuck traffic, that more people are going to actually start to use this stuff.
Well, you know, one thing that hasn't been converted to entirely electricity is floating around in the Mediterranean in a cruise ship.
Now, we should say that Leo is not weeping as he desperately tries to get the volleyball with his handprint on it that is lured away from him. We believe him to be safe.
We don't know that for sure, Andy. We don't know that.
Faith manages, Jason. Right, you know that as much as I do.
I do know that. Okay. I do think, though, that Leo is fine enough to tell us about our next sponsor.
Hi, Jason and company. One more quick spot before you wrap things up from our sponsor, LegalZoom. LegalZoom. You know, when I started Twit, I went to Kevin Rose. I said, I want to start a company. He said, you need to start an LLC? Go to LegalZoom.com. It's affordable. It's easy. It protects you. I trademarked the Twit name and the logo, all with LegalZoom. Over the past 17 years, I'm not alone, more than a million Americans have used LegalZoom to launch their businesses. Running a business there's a lot of paperwork. There's taxes. There's contracts. There's a lot of fine print. LegalZoom makes it easy, and it's a lot less expensive than going to a big law firm. LegalZoom's not a law firm. They have a network of independent attorneys and tax professionals, though, who can give you the advice you need to get through the daily grind of running your business. So it's like, you know, you've got lawyers working for you, but they're not a law firm. You don't have to worry about driving to somebody's office or being billed by the hour. You know, I've been in meetings with lawyers, and I look around and I say, 150 an hour, 250 an hour, 350 an hour, 450 an hour, and I add it all up. Every minute's costing me hundreds of dollars. I'm going, no! LegalZoom, you don't have to worry about that. They're not a law firm, but you can get great legal advice, and you can count on LegalZoom to provide the business resources you need and the service that fits into your schedule. Look, put your time and money where it counts. In your growing business, let LegalZoom handle the paperwork, the legal stuff. It is, for somebody starting out, it's a real boon. It's one of the things that's really making it possible for people to become entrepreneurs like you, right? You want to do it? Go to LegalZoom.com. Use the promo code TWIT at checkout. They've got a little special savings for you. Just to say thank you and thank you for me for using the offer code TWIT. That way they know that you heard it here. LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code TWIT. Like all our sponsors, we couldn't do TWIT without them, and we're very grateful. So it's nice if you can support them. They support us. LegalZoom.com. Use a promo code TWIT. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. And now I'd like you to meet Jason Snell. Jason?
Leo, are you on a barge? Are you on a boat? We don't know. He said he was sorry to barge in. I started to wonder if he may be like in a shipping container with a little light bulb hanging down or something. I don't know. We only have the one postcard from him so far. So it shows an airplane.
And that's a plane, and it shows a plane.
So there's really no facts here other than that they are going
just sending fresh iron goods down the Hudson River.
I'm sure everything is great.
15 and miles Leo, to
this is just me being envious of Leo being on an awesome vacation. And we are here. But friends, I have to add, but it's necessary. It's a sad moment as we get to the end of the show here, because as I said at the top of the show, I need to say RIP to an old friend, an old pal. It was with us. It supported us. It put space on the outside of our displays so that we could put our fingers all over the edges, and it didn't matter because we weren't touching the screen. Bezels are dead, apparently. The Verge reporting that at the IFA convention in Berlin, there were a lot of new laptops there. The bezels are going away. It's a style thing. It's nice. I mean, who needs a bezel? The iPads, which we didn't even talk about earlier, are rumored to be losing their bezels as well, in the same style as kind of the iPhone X. I recently bought a television, a 4K TV. I always thought the TV in my parents' house was enormous, and I realized that my TV is actually quite larger screen-wise than my mom's TV, but she's got me beat in bezels, because her TV's 10 years old and it's got these gigantic bezels that my TV doesn't have. So I just, you know, pour one out for the bezels is what I'm saying. Does anybody have strong pro bezel feelings that they want to get out? You might want to do it now because we may never talk about bezels ever again.
Let them die. Let them die.
It's a natural way of things. Natural way of things.
They need to go.
They're pining for the fjords even now.
I'm, you know, because the thing is, on a laptop, here's one thing. If you have a bezel, that means that you can have a really nice solid frame, a metal subframe around it that maybe will protect the thing from flexing and breaking. And if you have a bezel, that means that you don't have to have like a web camera that pops out from the damn keyboard, which is just plain wrong. And if you have a bezel and you got a computer with a touchscreen, it means that you got a place when you're basically got your coffee in one hand and you're scrolling with your thumb on the other, you got a place to rest your thumb without putting a mouse click in there. And I don't think bezels are a bad thing.
Do you know how grouchy you sound right now? Oh my goodness.
Because if Andy
will not speak for the bezel, who will?
I'll speak for it.
Oh,
speak
Ben. Oh,
I'm,
oh boy.
I'm also pro bezel.
Okay.
I think the design point that Andy makes when it comes to sort of protecting your screen is a really interesting one, because I guess I don't have anything really that is bezel-less. Not even the mirrors in my house are bezel-less when I think about it. But I do think that that does seem like a potential design issue with breaking screens easily. I drop my laptop probably once a quarter, and I feel like when that happens with a bezel-less screen, it's going to be a bigger problem than it is right now. And I also think about, you know, you think about frames for photographs. Like I remember in the very early days of like posting photos online, I want to say it was Instagram, but I actually don't know if that's true. But posting photos online, I would always add, you know how you could like add the frame to the picture, like add a black frame around the picture? I used to always do that because I just thought it looked better. So I'm curious to see what laptops will actually look and feel like without bezels. I haven't seen one IRL yet. So I don't know. I feel like we might miss the bezel.
It's possible. I wanted to mention, I have actually right in front of me for this entire show, I've had an iPad with this is called the Bridge keyboard. It's an add-on Bluetooth keyboard.
Yep.
And the way it works, it's very good. It turns this into a full-on kind of laptop style, and I can just lift the iPad out when I don't want it to be a laptop anymore. I like it.
Except when you don't have a bezel on that, it's going to get tricky.
So the way this thing works, it's in these clips, and the clips are against the bezel. And if the whole thing's a screen, the whole thing falls apart, and now I don't even know how they're going to do it. I hope that there will be some way for them to make a keyboard like this for the next one, because it's just there you go. The clips are touching the bezel. That's how it works. So I need a little bit of bezel there. Plus, when I'm resting my thumb, you need a designated thumb resting area, I think.
I hope you'll forgive the joke, Jason, but that is the ultimate edge case
It is. Well, my point is that bezels, you never know when you're going to need a bezel for your thumb or some weird add-on or whatever. But at the same time, I fully support pushing bezels further to the edges. I do wonder if this is an extreme style change that might get backed off at some point, because there are going to be like Apple, when they narrowed the bezels on the iPad, had to write new software for their touch detection to ignore certain kinds of touches. And quite frankly, I can tell sometimes that I am, mistouching the corner of the iPad because my thumb is just kind of a little bit over off onto the touchscreen. And so it's like, maybe this could be solved technically so that Andy can rest his thumb wherever the heck he wants. But it is, an added complication.
Yeah, I don't want people to start thinking that bezels are if something has a bezel, then somebody screwed up or somebody's not trying, or the worst phrase to find in any particular happens most often on an Apple blog. But it just shows you the designers of this company, they just don't get it. Like,
I thought you were going to say if you see a bezel, they blew it. That would be another one.
Exactly. That's also true. But I was having a conversation with somebody who was saying, well, see, in fairness, if it Someone was saying that, well, when I was once again, because I will never stop complaining about phones and other certain devices that don't have like don't have jacks, actual headphones jacks on them, because I still think I still feel as though that is designing a headphone jack inside your device is something that the engineers don't want to do, and so they'll much rather inconvenience the users rather than themselves. But the problem, one of the problems that bezel-less devices cause is that, as this person was saying to me, because they had to move the display drivers places, if they put a headphone jack in now, you couldn't have a bezel-less screen. And I'm like, oh God, I don't want to live in a world that I can actually plug in headphones, that I don't have to like be stuck without music or video because I don't have the right kind of headphones with me. But I do have that little sliver of a bezel someplace, that little strip of black that's like a big virulent globule of pus with teeth and eyes that's telling me about every failure I've ever had. It's just a bezel. It's okay. You'll live.
I feel like I want to deliver the case against bezels because there are three very pro-bezel people here.
Okay. Before you go, your vote is riding on this. I'm not in your district.
I know.
I don't think. Do you live in my district? Do you?
I'm saying conceptually. I'm not in your district.
Okay.
I would if I could.
Okay.
What is your position?
What is your campaign's position on bezels?
Neutrality and many other things might be more relevant than my one on bezels. But I would say this: have you picked up an iPhone, 6 Plus or 7 Plus or 8 Plus lately? Because if you do, it's really, for me, it's like you get your iPhone 10, right? And you're holding it, and something I love is I don't have like the pain in my pinky finger that I used to have with the other, because it's like resting this giant rectangle on it. It's like for something like an iPhone where you're carrying it around all the time, every millimeter matters. Like, we're all happy when Apple gets it like a few millimeters thinner. So I think on the iPhone, like, we know how they did this. It's not a mystery. They developed the iPad and they made the bezels thinner. And along the way, Apple developed some anti-edge touching technology that they brought to their entire line of phones. By that, they were able to use that space more efficiently. For me as a software engineer, I can't tell you how many times I've been looking at code and it's like 30 lines and you challenge yourself and go, well, can I get down to 28 lines? Can I think of another way to write this? Can I do it so if I like run data through this, it will do it more efficiently? I love more efficient designs, and I don't think bezels are always a waste, but I think like in your living room, that's certainly like a waste of your living room. You know, I think if on a mobile device, it's really a waste of that. So, is this like a blanket statement that you should never have bezels? Of course not. But I do think, generally speaking, that trend is a positive thing for our industry.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's extremism in bezels. I cannot believe that's a phrase I just said. I think some of it is a good striving to be. I'm sorry, I'm touching my bezels on my iPad as I talk. There it is. Oh, yeah, that's those thumbs. Look, see, you just rest right there.
Your bezels, they know we're talking about it, and it's worried. That's why you should be caressing it and reassuring it.
It's okay. So my point is, I think some of this may come out as being fashion, and people are like, you know what? A little bit of a frame around something, it's okay. But there are also places where bezels could get smaller because they're probably too big.
Sure.
And I agree with that, too. That's, look at me. Everybody's a little bit right. And isn't that the best way to end this edition of TWiT? I think maybe it is. I want to thank my wonderful guests for being here. Ben Brock Johnson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great riding with you.
Where can people find the stuff that you do? What's the best place?
Yeah, so I make a podcast about Reddit. It's called Endless Thread, and you can find it at wbur.org/endlessthread. We are also on Reddit as endless_thread, and I am on Twitter as The Brock Johnson in my tribute to the next president of the United States, Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
All right, and speaking of public radio in Boston, Andy Anatka, where can people find the stuff that you do?
I'm on WGBH every couple of weeks talking for a half hour about technology. My next appearance is, I think, on Friday, I think at 11:30. I think we're actually at the Boston Public Library. So if you want to watch.
It's a great
watch
space.
The magic of
you
public
can have
radio
a sandwich
live.
And watch radio
exactly.
live. Yeah.
It's beautiful. And I also do the Mac Break Weekly every week here at on Tuesdays. I do the Material Podcast for the Mighty Relay.fm. And you can find most of the stuff that I write or links to it on my Twitter feed and my Instagram feed. Both are Anatko. The price of admission is you have to spell my last name.
That's right.
Just don't speak it backwards
focus.
Or I get zapped back into my focus. Dimension.
And you can do it right. Brianna Wu, Tuesday is Election Day. Where can people find you and the stuff that you do?
So, you know, the reason I decided to come on Twit this week, when we're in the middle of a get out the vote effort here in District 8, is because every time I come on, you're all so amazingly generous with your campaign donations. Like, even as I'm sitting here, I watch people from the chat room donating to my campaign. So if you want to support real technological competence in Congress, which is a low bar,
we only need
8 people in the House to know what we're doing. That is what I'm running for. I would be honored to have your support. And you can do that by going to supportbrianna.com. You know, winner lose this time. I'm going to run again in 2020. I'm in this field for good. We need people to understand technology in Washington, D.C. I also do a podcast with the illustrious and awesome Christina Warren, who mm-hmm. often appears here on Twit. And you can find that at Relay FM as well.
All right. And yes, amen to all of that. You can find my stuff. I do tech podcasts at Relay FM, including Upgrade and Download and other shows that have directions in them, probably. And you can find my pop culture podcast at theincomparable.com and my writing about technology at sixcolors.com. Thank you so much to Leo and everybody here at Twit for having me host the big show this week. It's an honor. And with that, I think it's all done. This episode of Twit is in the can, and the can is bobbing in the Mediterranean. We'll see you next week.